Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 194 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is sponsored by CanvasPeople.com. CanvasPeople.com lets you take your favorite photo memories and turn them into works of art.
Now, Summer and I just got our first prints from CanvasPeople.com, and we are in love. And the reason we're in love is because... we both got a picture that we're in love with. It's actually Summer's picture. It was the fairy tale. It looks fake. It looks like it's CGI. This beautiful fairy tale kind of looking shot of a forest, like a glen, literally a glen, Kilmartin Glen in Scotland, and a bed of bluebells. It is just gorgeous.
We took this picture with my phone. And so it's been living in my phone and in places on the internet for years. And it's kind of like, well, what can we do with it? What else can we do with this photo? We've used it in so many different places. And when we found out about canvaspeople.com, we were like, we knew exactly what picture we wanted to use. And it's perfect. Their 11 by 14 photo to canvas prints are normally $69, but they are having a limited time offer where you can get one 11 by 14 print free. You just pay the shipping.
So go to canvaspeople.com and use promo code Outlander to get your favorite photo turned into a work of art.
That's canvaspeople.com with promo code Outlander. And now on to our read-along. Let's just start with chapter 42, entitled The Man in the Moon.
Thankfully, doesn't have much to do as supercargo until they arrive on land, and he has to help get rid of the cargo. Also, thankfully, he was cured for the time being of seasickness by Mr. Willoughby's needles. He assists where he can, which wasn't much, but he liked helping out at the gunnery practice and chatting cannons. Marsali, Claire, and Mr. Willoughby all sat safely with Fergus, who was not able to take part because of his missing hand. Claire, we find out, is now accepted as acting surgeon, but even keeping the crew healthy, she was not overworked. So basically, what Diana is trying to tell us is that they had a lot
She's
of free
bored.
Time. She's bored. Exactly.
And they know what happens when Claire gets bored.
Oh my gosh.
Bad things happen. You need to keep her busy.
They finally have time to talk. They are reacquainting themselves still and again with each other. Lisa T. writes, "It is ironic that the voyage itself is what gives them time together. They do not have the same daily responsibilities they had before. It's almost like a honeymoon, except, of course, they can't share a cabin." There's that one little thing. Martina P. writes, "Claire and Jamie have more free time together, as his job as supercargo will not really begin until they reach Jamaica. After all the different adventures, we luckily get some very precious Jamie-Claire moments and delightful conversations. I always enjoy Jamie's curiosity and fascination with Claire's time." They note the moon in the sky, and Jamie notes, quote, "It seems so close you could speak to the man in the moon," unquote. Claire says that when she left, they were getting ready to fly to the moon. They discuss flying machines and how it was rockets that would be used to go so far. She describes how there is no air in space and that it must be taken with them. And she describes to Jamie what it looks like, the moon. Quote, "Not unlike Scotland, except that it isn't green," unquote. He remembers his pictures of Brianna and takes them out. He's very careful of when and where he takes them out. I mean, Cranesmere, sorry. And, oh, not just that, Paris, although that was not as dangerous. He stops on the photo of Brie in her bikini, playing with a boy named Rodney. He asks Claire if that situation isn't a bit indecent. She replies that the bathing suit is actually quite modest for the time, but Jamie, while maybe not the biggest fan of that swimsuit, actually means the fact that she's outside, quote, almost naked before a man, unquote.
Well, Claire says, dressed in less clothing than most of the women at Madame Jean's or Jean or whatever her name is.
Yep.
I mean, Claire wrapped in a blanket had more covering on her down at the breakfast table than she does. Yeah,
exactly. Well, Claire says that boys and girls actually do play together, and they play together dressed like that sometimes. Claire is impressed by this new side of Jamie she'd never seen, the ferocious Scottish father. For the first time, I thought that perhaps it was not altogether a bad thing that he wasn't able to oversee Bree's life personally, Claire says. He would have frightened the living daylights out of any lad bold enough to try to court her. Martina P. writes, Jamie is guarding Bree's photographs like a treasure, and whenever he looks at them, he is filled with joy and pride, and we always get the loveliest conversations. Bree on the beach in a bikini represents an uncertainty of morals of the time for this 18th century Scottish Highland father. Claire's explanation about 20th century women with their freedom and being able to marry for love and not out of necessity for male protection is even, for this forward-thinking Scotsman, unimaginable. Jamie says, quote, if there is no need for a man to protect a woman and care for her, then I think it is a very poor time, unquote. Claire manages to reassure him that his daughter is able to support herself because she has a great education and is a very good and smart woman. So then Jamie asks Claire if she thinks Bree is a virgin. LOL. Remember, this question reflects the status of women at the time, in Jamie's time, in their now time. She reassures him, quote, Bree's a very good girl. Frank and I may not have got on so well together, but we were both good parents to her, if I do say so, unquote. Notice she didn't really answer the question. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least in the quote that I quoted.
Because it's none of her business, and it's none of his business. It's Bree's business, and Bree's, I think, business. She's trying to let that kind hang. Of explain that without having to point it out exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Then he asks Claire if she thinks it was a good idea to come to him when she did. Wouldn't Bree need her? Claire responds that, yes, it was. Because they were afraid if she didn't go right away, she may not be able to find him. I understand that question of Jamie's, but I also, that's got to be, I think that's a harder question than, like, do you miss her? What is it like? I mean, that's all, like, you know, she misses her and she can reminisce and she can be sad that she's not around her. But, and he wasn't doubting. He still wants her there. He loves her. There's no question. He does not want her to go back. But how difficult for Claire must it have been to hear that, knowing that he did not mean anything badly by it, but how difficult must it have been for her to hear? Wouldn't it have been better to stay maybe a little bit longer? Doesn't she need you?
I think that she's already had that thought, mm-hmm. and it's already something she's stressed and worried about. And it's like, I promise you, she's already thought of that, Jamie, mm-hmm. and she came anyway. So maybe you need to, she's already done all her worrying. It's just going to make it worse. Because I think that when you as a singular person make a decision and you find peace with it and you move forward with it, and then somebody comes back and starts second guessing it, it just throws a wrench in the works. And you're like, ugh, mm-hmm. I knew it was the right decision 10 minutes ago, and then you brought it up and ruined it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm looking for the stones.
Huh. Lisa T. writes, so Jamie, unlike Frank, worries about Bree being with her mother, but for 18th century male reasons. Just as Jamie can't conceive of flying machines going to the moon, he does not understand the role of men or the freedom of women in the 20th century. Claire also reassures him that Bree is getting an education and will be able to make her own money and take care of herself, financially at least. Jamie isn't too impressed by this. Claire stresses not that there was no need for a man, but that she could choose to have one. And anyway, in the end, Bree had made her go. But she left her a letter, and that was the one thing she could do. Claire had taken some time at their Boston home to get things in order, and she describes a picture of her mother that Uncle Lamb had kept. And so this is more discussion of ties to past and future. So not only is she literally in the past, in the 18th century, her past, which is Bree, is in the future. So, you know, a lot of little tangled things here. As she's preparing to write her last letter to Bree, she's going through some of her parents' things. And that's more of her tie, Bree's tie as well. Lisa T. writes, as I mentioned much earlier in the read-along, I think that Jamie is the much more maternal of the two of them. I would love to have heard his advice in a letter. But even Claire is a bit sarcastic about her ability to give motherly advice. Partly because she didn't remember her own mother, and partly because she was an untraditional mother for her time.
I don't disagree. I think she's a terrible letter writer. That letter... I hate that letter. And mostly it's because of the last line. I love almost all of that letter until she says that last line. And I'm like, you literally, and I know why she did it, but I feel like it negated the honest and true moments of the rest of that letter to throw that out there.
We're going to get there. I hear you. We're going to get there. Eileen P. writes, regarding Uncle Lamb keeping the car registration, I think it's very interesting that Uncle Lamb kept the registration of the car that killed Claire's parents. While Claire thinks there is little significance of him saving it, I think there might be more to it than that. Maybe this will be something herself will explore in future books. I believe she said she wasn't interested in writing about Claire's parents, but why bother mentioning the car registration? It makes me wonder if Claire's parents' car accident wasn't actually an accident. I love when Claire and Jamie talk about Brianna. It's so sweet to see Jamie as the loving father, even when talk of male suitors turns him into a ferocious Scottish father. Claire describes to Jamie the process of writing her letter to Bree. Now, I will say, this is Ginger, not as Claire. It was really hard to get through this, especially listening to Davina. And she starts it with, quote, "You are my baby and always will be," unquote. Lisa T. writes, I wonder if Claire is thinking of Faith here as well. Quote, Bree, you are worth everything and more. I've done a great many things in my life so far, but most important of them all was to love your father and you. Choose a man like your father, I wrote. Either of them. I shook my head over that. Could there be two men more different? But left it, thinking of Roger Wakefield. Once you've chosen a man, don't try to change him, I wrote, with more confidence. It can't be done. More important, don't let him try to change you. He can't do it either, but men always try, unquote. Roger is both Frank and Jamie. He is both historian and Highlander. It is interesting that Claire suggests Bree choose a man like either of her fathers, especially after the unhappy years with Frank. I think she is alluding to Frank being an honorable man. But then she does add not to let a man try and change her. Frank didn't so much try to change Claire, think the wine-smashing scene, but he did have to learn to respect and accept who she was. And then what Summer is talking about, this beautiful letter ends with, quote, stand up straight and try not to get fat, unquote.
Oh, that makes me so mad.
tell us, girl. You know, tell us. Lay it out.
The thing is that I know that Claire wrote it not in jest per se, but kind of to lighten the mood of the letter and to kind of have a little dose of humor at the end. But to me, it almost negated all of the nice things that she said in the course of the letter, things that I would have taken to heart and things that I'm like, she's so right about that. That's such a true statement. I totally agree. And then you say that and I'm like, well, now you're saying that the only worth she will have as a human being is if she stands up straight and doesn't get fat. Like that feels like to me, that's the one thing she's going to leave her with. Cause everyone always remembers the last thing that you said in a letter. And that's what she's going to remember. Don't get fat. Okay. Thanks, Mom.
I understand that it is more controversial than one might think. And I think, like you, it was entirely meant as a lighthearted kind of, I don't want to leave this on an incredibly sad note, because the entire letter is, while it's full of advice and it's sad because of the tone and sad because of why she's writing it, I also think it was written to lighten it at the end and kind of make her, you can imagine someone reading it and then going, you know what I'm saying? Involuntarily. I could imagine an actress, a person or whatever. I think the reader probably on the first time, whether you're listening to it, because you definitely can't see it, I can imagine this guffaw coming out like, what? Even if you're totally like turned off by it and like pissed off at it, I can imagine going, what? You know what I'm saying? Like, what was that? Because it comes out of left field. I understand the humor, and I also understand if it upsets people, because I completely understand. Jamie replies to this, quote, I think she will do very well, for no matter what poor Gawk has fathered her, no lass has ever had a better mother. Kiss me, Sassenach, for believe me, I wouldn't have changed you for the world, unquote. Lisa T. writes, I love the imagery of the glowing moon rising like a phoenix. I think it's a metaphor for Jamie. He has been so distraught between being shot, the fever, and Ian's kidnapping, and his seasickness. But like the glowing moon, like a phoenix from the flames, he is rising again. Claire quotes a poem by A.E. Housman, based on the stories of the Seven Sisters, and a fragment of the ancient female poet Sappho. The weeping Pleiades wester, and the moon is under seas. From bourn to bourn of midnight, far sighs the rainy breeze. It sighs from a lost country to a land I have not known. The weeping Pleiades wester, and I lie down alone. This is very appropriate, especially the second stanza, as Claire has not only lost her country of 20th century, but Scotland and even France. She is off to a land that she doesn't know and unfortunately must lie alone. It's a scary and heart-wrenching thing that Claire did by leaving her child. Again, her heart is divided in two different times, but this time it is different. Bree will always be a part of her. Lisa T. continues, Jamie is so comforting and sweet in this moment. He gives Claire the love, validation, and affirmation that she needs. And just as she has gotten a glimpse at Jamie as a father, Jamie truly sees Claire as an adult Bree's mother, and he loves her in a whole new way. Eileen P. writes, I love when Claire and Jamie talk about Brianna. It's just so sweet to see Jamie as the loving father, even when talk of male suitors turns him into a ferocious Scottish father. Claire's letter to Brianna was so beautiful and heartfelt, it was heart-wrenching for Claire to leave Brianna for Jamie. But on hearing what Claire wrote in the letter, Jamie shattered all Frank's negative remarks about Claire as a mother by saying, quote, no lass has ever had a better mother, unquote. Erica B. writes, I would love to have heard more of the stories they shared in the ship during their downtime. Diana doesn't go into much of what was shared, so we don't know how this other stuff will play out in the books. I wonder if Claire talks about Joe. I think it would make a fun novella to be put together. God knows it is full of bits we haven't heard yet. I also really enjoy the scene of Jamie and Claire chatting about the moon and then Bree. It's interesting that he doesn't think twice about the idea of traveling to the moon, but the idea of his daughter in a bikini standing next to him, a boy, the horror. That's funny. Or just his general opinion of how the two times are really so different. He's got a very difficult time with it. Anybody feel like his level of love for the photos is right up there with Gollum and the One Ring? My precious.
Oh, good Lord. He should be. He's never seen anything like them before. No one else has them in that time period.
I know.
Why shouldn't he treat them like his precious?
And I can't.
And they are his precious.
They are.
They're his daughter.
They are. I can't imagine leaving my kids. The pain that Claire went through writing that letter to Bree must have been immense. Joe B. writes, if a baby daughter challenges Jamie's assumptions about the world, a grown daughter who is university educated in the midst of a sexual revolution and without strong masculine influence does his head in. It seems that this might have been a previous topic of conversation, as Claire says that Jamie doesn't really believe her. What goes some way to convincing Jamie that leaving Bree to sort her own life out is not a dereliction of duty is Claire using the example of herself. It's true that she married Jamie for need, but she both stayed with him after the witch trial and came back by her choice for love. I think, as always, when Bree is brought to mind, there's a stab of guilt in Claire, thus some defensiveness. The letter she has written to Bree is condensing all the advice she can into one tome. It is also important, and reinforcing of Claire's return, that Bree was so supportive. Jamie needs to know that Bree was involved in the decision. Seeing he has touched a nerve, Jamie uses his humor to diffuse tension, deprecating himself while praising Claire, bringing them physically close, and relying on the power of their kiss to assure her. I also notice a strong similarity between the end of this scene to the last scene of Episode 1, Series 2, of the TV show. Martina P. writes, upon Claire's reflection, we learn about the content of a letter she has written to Bree. What a testimony of love and joy. It's just heartbreakingly beautiful. Claire's words really moved me and made me feel like a bad mother because there is no way I can remember such details of my own four children. She concludes her letter with some motherly advice to choose a man like her father, either of them, and that she should not attempt to change a man and not let one change her either. Stand up straight, take care of your skin, try not to get fat. This, if I may say so, is so typically Diana, ending heartbreak with humor. She masters this like no other. In regard to selection of a husband, either of her fathers, could be one person, right? The Scottish historian Roger Wakefield, who does possess some Jamie qualities and some better parts of Frank. Jamie commends Claire on her motherly instincts and assures her that he wouldn't change her for the world.
And that was chapter 42. Moving right along to chapter 43, entitled Phantom Limbs.
Martina P. starts us off. The title Phantom Limbs could possibly mean more than the three amputees on the small ship. Maybe it could also apply to Jamie and Claire when they were apart. They are only whole when they are together. So over time, they relax around the six smugglers, though Claire feels some reserve toward all of them, save Innes. He was extra reserved. She sees him in pain one morning and brings him to her surgery for an examination. She finds out that he hasn't BM'd in 4 days. As she examines him, there's an, quote, audience of heads peering curiously around the doorway. Poor Innes. Yeah, there's a reason we have closed medical exams. Even if you're just looking at my toe, I don't care. We have closed exam rooms. Thank you, God. The diagnosis? Another thing you want your companions seeing and hearing? It's belly gas and constipation. Claire inquires about his diet and is shocked to learn of the general lack of fiber of the crew's mess. She'd purposefully procured peas and oatmeal for the voyage, but it seems neither was getting to the crew. The real blockage, it seems, is Cook Murphy. He takes his time to craft the meals for the captain's table, but doesn't give much of a rat's about the crew's eats. And he was downright prejudiced against oatmeal, even referring to it as dog's vomit. I mean, it kind of looks it. And cat's vomit.
They clearly weren't
mixing in, you know, maple and brown sugar.
Eggs or raisins, yeah.
Or raisins and spice, or apples and cinnamon.
Or everything nice.
Can you blame him? Nobody wants to talk about being constipated. Nobody wants to admit to that. Nobody wants to bring attention to their bowels, ever. I mean, I know a couple people who do. But for the most part, that's not something people want to... I'm not going to talk about that.
Oh, but that's not me.
No, it's not. Ginger.
So some of the men that knew that they should be receiving porridge, as Fergus had mentioned it to them, but they didn't want to bother complaining when they found it wasn't their part of their diet. Claire says she'll talk to Murphy and gives the men some herbs to brew a tea with. And then pure Diana, quote, as if in answer to this, a high squeaking fart emerged from under Innes to an ironic cheer from his colleagues, unquote. And Lisa T., I agree with you. She says, I hope they leave this scene in for comic relief. So Claire chats with Murphy, and it was decided that she would be responsible for prepping the Scots' mooring pottage as long as she kept it to one pot and spoon and did not sing while she cooked. Well, I guess that's Ginger out of commission. I would never be
Ginger. You don't cook.
What? I cook Blue Apron. Don't give me this. So Claire contrasts the situation on the boat with the custom at Lallybroch. There, the tenants would have had no hesitation of approaching their laird about such a manner. Indeed, Jamie would have known what was wrong before they came to tell him. And this distance troubled Claire. Lisa T. writes, the fact that Jamie doesn't know about the constipation situation...
Lisa! Is that the latest Schoolhouse Rocks?
I didn't read this before.
Is that like Conjunction Junction?
Constipation Station.
Oh my goodness. It's troubling to Claire. She realizes that he's not the laird and they are not his men. I mean, she knew it, but it kind of hit her again. Jamie goes out on a wee boat to fish with some of the other men. And when he comes back, asks Claire about Innes. Quote, what have you done to Innes? He's hiding in the starboard head and says you told him he must not come out until he'd... at all until he'd shit, unquote. The truth? She said if he didn't BM that night, she'd give him an enema of slippery elm bark.
Y'all, you do not understand how much of an incentive it is to try to poop on your own.
But you've never had slippery elm bark. Oh, wait. If you had it. Okay, never mind.
No. Well, I'm just saying. Somebody threatening to interfere.
Oh, with the stuff.
With your junction. Backside. is a powerful motivator.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure.
To take care of things on your own.
Lisa T writes, poor Ennis, slippery elm, better than cascara, but the threat, quote, the genesis of the oatmeal war, unquote. I love her self-sarcastic sense of humor. So Claire tells Jamie also of the oatmeal war, and as we expect, Jamie is not happy about this. Quote, they should have come to me, he says, unquote. These men aren't like his tenants at the Brach. He pays these men. He says, there was more die to Culloden than the Stuart cause, Sassenach. Unquote. Martina P. writes, the oatmeal war on board the ship and Jamie's unawareness of it has probably a deeper meaning. It demonstrates that the relationship he has with his crew is much different than the relationship he would have had with his tenants as Laird of Lallybrach and the Fraser clan. The next week, Innes came to her of his own volition, asking about phantom pain. He'd spoken with Fergus and Murphy, both of whom said they'd had it. Innes had lost his arm due to blood poisoning. He'd torn a hole in his hand with a nail, and it festered. But it was the loss of his arm that had saved him from being transported to the colonies with the others. The other prisoners from Ardsmuir. So now we know what happened to those men, all sent off to be indentured servants. We also learned that Innes was one of Jamie's, MacDuv's, Ardsmuir men. Claire consults with Dr. And this time I did write it on purpose. Claire consults with Dr. Willoughby, and he does have something he can try. He pressed on certain spots on Innes' neck and torso. Willoughby tries to explain what he is doing, and then he burns some hot peppers and spits onto Innes' stump. Quote, spit on ghost, Mr. Willoughby says. It has actually somehow helped reduce or eliminate the pain. And Mr. Willoughby says Innes can spit on his own ghost now. Because Innes was like, you do that again. Don't. And Mr. Willoughby's like, there's no need. You can totally handle it yourself now. Martina P. writes, Claire is practicing her skills and I love the cooperation with Mr. Willoughby. He applies his medical knowledge and together they are able to help Duncan Innes even if there is a wee bit of trickery involved. Eileen P. writes, poor Innes and the Scottish crew being deprived of their pottage diet by Murphy, the gourmet chef. How many of you had a flashback to King Louis and his backed up plumbing? I know I did, and I didn't necessarily want to go there. Could we not have been introduced to Innes some other way? After meeting Innes, Claire observes that Jamie's other men are not like his tenants at Lallybrach. To the men, Jamie is just an employer. There is not the same extent of loyalty as to a laird. However, with Innes, it is different, because he and Jamie were in Ardsmuir prison together. At Ardsmuir, Jamie took on the role of laird to his fellow prisoners. These revelations add to the suspicions that one of Jamie's men has betrayed him and is possibly trying to kill him. However, it is unlikely to be Innes. Erica B. writes, how frustrating for Claire that she made an effort to make sure the crew had some decent food to find that Murphy refused to make it. And now no one was pooping, all because they didn't want to bother Jamie with the fact they weren't getting their pottage. Joe B. writes, loyal former resident of Ardsmuir, Duncan Innes, experiences the well-documented but no less painful for it phenomenon of phantom limbs. He has only one arm. So like Jamie, he isn't transported, rather pardoned and left to his own devices. Duncan's loyalty is further offered to Jamie, as with giving Duncan a job in Edinburgh, he, Jamie, in essence, saves Duncan's life. Duncan raises another reason why Jamie wasn't sent away with the rest of the prisoners, his status as a known and influential Jacobite. It would be a risk to send Red Jamie Fraser with a group of angry men to a place that is not only further away from the Crown's scrutiny, it would be a risk to send Red Jamie Fraser with a group of angry men to a place that is not only further away from the Crown's scrutiny, but add to this that he might then be able to use the Frenchman's gold to start another Stuart Rising, another legitimate and publicly acceptable reason for Lord John to intervene, so not to send Jamie away. Lisa T. writes, I think the missing limb is a great metaphor for Claire's heart, no matter which time period she is in. Quote, I see. I rub my chin, pondering. Yes, it is common. It's called a phantom limb, when you still have feelings in a part that's been lost. Unquote. Claire lost Frank, Faith, Jamie, and even though she returned to him, she left Bree. Even though she is with Jamie, she still feels for all of them, even though they are lost to her. They are the phantoms of her heart. Claire finds out that Innes was in Ardsmuir with Jamie, and so Innes regards Jamie differently than the other men. Claire, never one to dismiss unorthodox ways to heal, think Bouton, asks Mr. Willoughby what they could do for Innes's phantom limb. The spitting on the stump to keep the ghost away reminds me of pissing on the doorposts to keep the ghosts out.
And that was chapter 43. I guess we're going to motor on to chapter 44, wrap this episode up, and discuss chapter 44, entitled Forces of Nature.
Jamie calls himself a fool as he observes to Claire that after spending 20 years wanting her in his bed, he is now kept from her.
I can't disagree with him.
No, I'd be pretty pissed off too. And it was his own fault.
Right. This is like the worst planning ever.
They'd had a few attempts at answering the call of their carnal desires, but they were attempts only. So they must be content with playing thumb war. Martina P.
Is that a euphemism?
Well, they're playing handsies. But go for whatever you want to go with. Martina P. writes, Jamie is lamenting their voluntary celibacy due to a stepfatherly concern for Marsali. Claire informs us about several unsuccessful attempts to be intimate, and they were interrupted by a rat coming down on Jamie's shoulder. To be honest, I have a hard time imagining that a rat would stop Jamie from engaging in sexual activities. The Jamie I know would have thrown that rat across the room and continued with the task at hand. Jamie...
But the issue was that it landed on her and she screamed. She was the one that startled. So it's like once she's taken out of the moment, she's going to be the harder one. Yeah. She's like, yeah, we're going to have to cool it on this because there's rats in here.
She finishes with, Jamie is the best multitasker and we all know it. Lisa T. writes, so they are feeling the mild strain of abstinence. And just because it is beautiful and lusty, quote, he glanced down at our linked hands, or my thumb continued to make secret love to his palm and narrowed his eyes at me. But let me continue.
It sounds so dirty.
This is the thumb war. He closed his fingers gently around my hand, his own thumb feather light on my pulse. The simple fact was that we couldn't keep our hands off each other. No more than Fergus and Marsali could, despite the fact that we knew very well such behavior would lead only to greater frustration. Unquote. He tells Claire how he has to hear Fergus lusting across the room at night and mentions the time at Ardsmuir, where men had to do their own thing. He says, quote, it seemed a great deal easier to go mad than having always to think what to do next, but it doesn't seem to come natural to me, nor does buggery. Unquote. I thought it was funny. Claire's like, so what does lusting sound like? Well, Claire,
it's like how it's like the smartest person in the room becomes the dumbest person in the room in the course of one sentence. Mm-hmm. It's just that moment of she's like, which this was so not characteristic for mm-hmm. Claire, as far as I'm concerned, because for the most part, she is equal parts book smart and street smart.
Yeah, I could go with that.
Whereas, you know, I know a lot of super smart people who don't know what crop dusting means. Lord. Hint, hint. But but usually they don't get all of the above. So it was like, this was a rarity for Claire, who usually has both in hand and is, you know, on top of it, paying attention and gets it because she grew up around a lot of men. So for her to have that moment of surprise with something about this, I found shocking.
It is rather entertaining. I will give you that. Erica B. writes, the opening scene with Jamie and Claire reminds me of being a teenager in love. I like that they have to suffer through this hidden flirting courting because this was part of their relationship that was missed. Fergus is tickling Marsali and with an albatross feather. Do you think herself intended any symbolism with this? At least he wasn't wearing an albatross around his neck. Perhaps the, quote, burden is that they couldn't behave like proper married folk. I can't imagine the breeks Jamie is wearing to hide his desires all that well. I don't know how a kilt would do either, for that matter. Perhaps a bit better as it has more weight to it? Honestly, I didn't even think about that. I just thought about their thumbs. I mean, their hands.
Say that one more time.
I can't imagine the breeks Jamie is wearing hide his desired all that well. Hide his desires all that well. I don't know how a kilt would do either, for that matter. Perhaps a bit better, as it has more weight to it.
Haven't we talked about this before? We have talked about this before.
Sure, I think a kilt is always better, because it has folds.
Yeah, we talked about whether or not a kilt would be more effective.
Now, we never talked to... hiding a did we talk to a dude?
I know that I did. I don't know that we talked about it.
Okay, I know we talked about it, but I don't know that we talked to... a subject matter expert, like a dude. Joe B. writes, living with the realities of insisting on fatherly propriety is frustrating our favorite couple. What great images of them sneaking around the ship, trying to find conducive, if not romantic, spots for their encounters. What starts as a discussion about V and lack of marital relations leads to the first time Jamie has spoken specifically about prison and the added indignity of being in irons. Darkness may provide privacy and silence for others, but not for him. For Jamie, who has always had control of his body, even choosing to let others abuse it, for example, Black Jack Randall, waiting for others to fall asleep before he attends to his needs might be the least frustrating aspect of his restriction. How great that Claire is such an equal in their sexual relationship. Desire and need is strong for her. And she, in contrast to many women in romantic, in the broadest sense, stories, who are passive and reactionary. Claire is communicative of her needs and can initiate the getting of them. We learn more about Jamie's capture after all the years in the cave following Claudin. He had fought the soldiers even after he promised Jenny he wouldn't. He'd rebroken his finger a third time then. The second time had been at Culloden. And yes, as Joby mentioned, there's no privacy in prison. The cells were not large, and the men huddled close together for warmth. Jamie had been in chains for more than a year, and so if he'd taken advantage of the dark of night to relieve himself, people would have heard. Lisa T. writes, even though we knew about Jamie's time in Ardsmuir, these passages give us a glimpse inside Jamie's heart and mind. They make his time there very present and poignant. He tells Claire how much he wants her, and how easily... Quote, there are moments, Sassenach, for when one copper penny, I'd have you on the spot, back against the mast and your skirts about your waist, and devil take the bloody crew. Unquote. So we see here, even though it's a relatively peaceful time on the boat thus far, they are still separated. Then they're interrupted by the bell signaling dinner. Just before they go down, she gives him a penny. On account, let's go and eat. Unquote. Lisa T. writes, Jamie trusts Claire with his soul. He shares the most private parts of his soul with her. When she thinks, quote, the desire strong enough to have endured loneliness and degradation, squalor and separation, unquote, I think she finally begins to understand what Jamie's life in prison must have been like. It also shows Claire the depth of Jamie's desire. They may be lusting after each other, but there is so much more to it. She talks about his terrible need. The scene goes from light-hearted lusting to the deeply intimate, desperate desire of the soul. Eileen P. writes, it's interesting that herself chose to have Fergus tease Marsali with an albatross feather. According to Wikipedia, quote, the word albatross is sometimes used metaphorically to mean a psychological burden that feels like a curse. It is an allusion to Samuel Taylor Coleridge's poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. In the poem, an albatross starts to follow a ship. Being followed by an albatross was generally considered a sign of good luck. However, the titular mariner shoots the albatross with a crossbow, which is regarded as an act that will curse the ship, which indeed suffers terrible mishaps. Even when they are too thirsty to speak, the ship's crew let the mariner know through their glances that they blame his action for the curse. He feels as though the albatross is metaphorically hung around his neck. That is, when people look at him, they see him as the albatross killer, and that weighs on him. Thus, the albatross can be both an omen of good or bad luck, as well as a metaphor for a burden to be carried as penance. Unquote. And thank you, Eileen. We will also include that link to the Wikipedia entry in our show notes. So, she continues, is Fergus's albatross feather a good omen? A bad omen, Or is it a metaphor for a psychological burden? I can see it as being a metaphor for Fergus's burden of having a missing hand, which limits his work prospects and therefore makes him a poor choice for a husband. However, beyond that, I wonder if it also portends a good or bad omen for Fergus and Marsali as a couple. Okay, Eileen P., you win. You win this episode because, no, I didn't even think to look it up. No, I mean, not only, of course I didn't look it up. Wow, you just like took it and not just like found it. You like analyze. Go, girl, you win. The next day, they are taking their normal stroll around the deck when they stop and observe Willoughby painting on a large white sheet of paper. Some of the crew, as they pass by, go out of their way to walk too close to the paper. Then one kicked over his cake of black ink. Then they tried to blame Willoughby for the now not clean deck. They say awful things to him. Jamie involves himself, and rather smoothly. It seems that Mr. Willoughby does the work on the deck on purpose to provoke the crew. And Jamie, we find out through Jamie that there are other places available for Willoughby to work in. The reason? Jamie breaks the news of Willoughby and the feet. He describes the process of foot binding to Claire, and then what men like to do with the resultant result.
Which, can we just say that in the introduction of that part of the story made all of the foot fetish stuff worse. It's just, ugh. But I wanted to say this earlier. I've read these books, I don't know how many times over the years, and I still never consider the chains in prison keeping him from being able to take care of his business. I never think about that until it's mentioned again in this chapter every time through the book series.
Just because you don't think him relieving himself?
You know, it just doesn't cross my brain. Like, I know that he spent a good deal of the time in the prison with the chains, and he wanted the chains taken off, and da-da-da-da. So I know all of those things. But for whatever reason, my brain never immediately goes to, huh, that must make it really hard to jack off in prison with a room full of dudes. It never goes there. And then we hit this chapter, and then I'm like, oh, that's right. How awkward. But every time I've read this book, this has to be, I don't know, it's been what? This book's been out for probably almost 20 years now, and I've been reading it for close to that long-ish. And it's still, it's never the first thing that crossed. It's never something that I think about when he's talking about being in prison earlier in the book.
Erica B. writes, do you think it's true what Jamie says about why Mr. Willoughby has a foot fetish? I can't imagine the hole is that big. Erica, I don't think it's Jamie. I think that's history. It's true. We know that foot binding exists. You can go find photos. And if I'm not mistaken, Diana has mentioned that she's mentioned several times that when she's out and about and she sees really oddball books about topics that one would never necessarily, that she never like went to look for. She found a book on, I believe, on not foot fetishes, but on foot, if not foot binding, on something about this topic. And then I guess decided to, you know, used it for inspiration. But of course we know Mr. Willoughby's inspiration, the inspiration of him being there is for to help Jamie with the seasickness. Yeah, to flesh out his character, I believe it's most likely true, yes. Joe B. writes, Chinese foot binding began... Oh, here we go. Okay, just answer the question. Chinese foot binding began as a status symbol indicating a woman would never need to work, i.e. she was wealthy, and it became an erotic object. The ideal measurement of a woman's foot was considered to be an incredible 4 inches. Although banned in 1912, it still happened in some rural areas, and the practice died out with the rise of communism. Lisa T. writes, I can only imagine the look on Katrina's face when Jamie says to Claire, a hole. I hope we get to see this scene. I'd love to hear her say, quote, why that perverted little beast, unquote. Especially since he's made overtures to her feet. Martina P. writes, we find out why Mr. Willoughby is such a foot fetishist. While we get interesting and quite cruel facts about Chinese rituals, it is also very disturbing to learn about the sexual pleasure men get from mutilated feet. Or got. I mean, I don't know if they get it anymore, but got it at least. To Yi Tian Cho, the Scots and Europeans are the barbarians. This includes Jamie. And Jamie says it galls him that were it not for Jamie, he'd be beaten up or thrown overboard. But Jamie identifies with him. Quote, I do remember what it's like to have nothing but your pride and a friend. Unquote. Jamie had had Innes, likely, and Claire had had Joe Abernathy. But Mr. Willoughby, other than Jamie, has no one. Lisa T. writes, so we see Mr. Willoughby as the outlander, but he sees them as outlanders. Mr. Willoughby's description of Jamie is hilarious, but it also makes him human, real, and quite possibly stinky. It's a great contrast to Lord John's description of Jamie, but interestingly, they both refer to him as the devil, or Lucifer. Just then, Murphy erupts with oaths. A dead horse was in a cask and had to be dumped overboard. Murphy insulted the ship's chandler who had sold it to him. An Italian, Manzetti, was loading a musket. He was planning on shooting a shark. After several attempts, he was unsuccessful. They have to dump this cask because it's spoiling and rotting. It's just they cannot keep it on the ship. And it would just attract probably more rats and just a bad health situation, not hygienic. So they had to dump it. And why waste this opportunity? Because this dead, rotting flesh is going to attract sharks. And the men, the seafaring men, the seamen, they know that shark tastes pretty good. I mean, I'm having to believe them because I never tried it. I don't care to try it. But they have all these plans and they don't waste anything, of course. So they're like, oh my gosh, we're going to take advantage of this. Get a musket. Go get a gun. So he's getting ready once these sharks start to swarm. He's planning on getting one. He tries a few times, but he's unsuccessful. But the captain says he fancied shark to eat. And so they turned the Artemis. They turned the ship. And they lowered a boat. We find out that Murphy's leg was likely lost to a shark, hence his unequivocal glee at shooting as many of them as possible. Then Mr. Willoughby takes center stage. Our attention as readers are on this boat going down to get a closer aim at the sharks and hopefully to bring at least one in. And of course, then to Murphy, who is cackling with glee at bagging one. And then there's this commotion and we see Willoughby is wrestling a large bird. In the water. No one knew he had jumped overboard. What the heck? Jamie sees this and dives into the water. Or jumps, but he enters. The men on the boat, they have a shark. The men on the boat haul in the shark. Jamie hauls in Mr. Willoughby and the bird because Mr. Willoughby is not letting that bird go. He got the bird. But he didn't kill it. The shark is brought up. Murphy chops something off the shark. So the men go to town, they kill it, they chop stuff off, they do whatever they're doing, what they want to do. But why did Willoughby want a damn bird? It wasn't to eat. Jamie says to Claire, let's go down and you can help me dry, because he is, of course, sopping wet. And then he realizes what he had said. While there is plenty of commotion around the cabin, and while they have a very valid reason to be gone, they make a mad dash for his cabin. Quote, 30 seconds later, we were below in his cabin, unquote. His breeches are stuck.
Okay. I swear to God, it sounded like he just said we were blowing his cabin.
below.
Is that a euphemism?
No. His breeches are stuck to him. And this is so comical. Them trying to undress each other and hurry to complete the deed before they are missed on deck. He's just about to take her on the desk when Claire shrieks that someone is coming. Jimmy don't care. He does the deed. Lisa T. writes, really hoping we get to see this scene. It is so hot and so funny. Quote, he seized me, picked me up bodily, and laid me on the desk, heedless of crumpled papers and scattered quills. Tossing my skirts up past my waist, he grabbed my hips and half lay on me, his hard thighs forcing my legs apart. It was like grasping a salamander, a blaze of heat in a chilly shroud. I gasped as the tail of his sopping shirt touched my bare belly and then gasped again as I heard footsteps in the passage. Stop, I hissed in his ear. Someone's coming. Too late, he said, with breathless certainty. I must have you or die. He took me with one quick, ruthless thrust, and I bit his shoulder hard, tasting salt and wet linen, but he made no sound. two strokes, three, and I had my legs locked around his buttocks, my cry muffled in his shirt, not caring either who else might be coming. He had me quickly and thoroughly and thrust himself home and home and home again with a deep sound of triumph in his throat, shuddering and shaking in my arms, unquote. Thanks, Lisa. You know how to get me to read that crap.
Can I just say,
not crap. But
I was going to ask you at the end of that whole statement,
yeah,
who, cause I don't remember because it was such a long passage. I know. That I didn't remember.
It was Lisa.
Who you said it dated.
Of course.
God bless you, Lisa. That was the most amazing like 5 minutes of my life because I know how uncomfortable that made her. Yeah,
at least you didn't say the N word. I'm just kidding. Lisa continues, I love the urgency and passion in this scene, but I absolutely love when he says, quote, I must have you or die, unquote. Not sure whether to melt, faint, or break out into hysterical laughter. This chapter's brilliant mingling of playful lust and terrible need finally culminates in the ultimate release. Martina P. writes, all hell breaks loose when the crew throws a casket with rotting horsemeat overboard. Mr. Willoughby jumps into a... Jumps into shark-infested water to rescue a pelican, and Jamie has to jump in after him to save his life. After this heroic act, Jamie and Claire use the confusion on deck to sneak downstairs and engage in urgent and wild passion, which is always enjoyable to witness as a reader. Winky face. It is indeed a beautiful moment of Jamie and Claire connecting.
Literally. that the story about the shark... them basically chumming the water. Yeah. Reminded me of when we were in Hawaii a couple weeks ago, we went on this snorkeling tour, and the captain, when we were sailing out, the captain was saying, oh, well, we stop at one of these two places. Usually they're both near this power plant. There's a power plant like right on the coast of Oahu, on I think the western coast of Oahu. And they said, there's always, you know, a lot of fish right over by the power plants. And I just kind of took him at his word. I didn't know that. I mean, if he says that's why, you know, whatever. And I mentioned it to my dad and he said, that doesn't surprise me. And I was like, okay, why doesn't that surprise you? And because when my dad was, I don't know, in his 30s, I guess, or maybe younger, like in his 20s, he worked at a power plant and it was a steam power plant. So they would pull the water in through these underground like tunnels or grates or whatever. And fish would get caught in the intake. So when they would try to funnel the water back out, they had all these fish and they didn't know what to do with them. So what they started doing initially is that they would just grind them up with the water and send it back out. Well, the problem is they were basically chumming the water. So that was attracting more fish. So it was making their problem even more of a problem, which made me think about them chumming the water. And it was just like this unintended result of this power plant. Potentially, I don't know if that's what's going on, but that it might not be uncommon to have lots of fish around power plants if they are incidentally chumming the water around them.
2 minutes later, Innes comes in to get something for Mr. Willoughby. Innes is no fool. He knew what they'd done. Quote, you might should have Mr. Murphy make him some broth on that account, McDo. They do say it is dangerous to get chilled after hard work. Aye, you didn't want to take the ague. Unquote. And there was a twinkle in his eye. Jamie responds, if it comes to that, Innes, at least I shall die a happy man. It turns out Mr. Willoughby had wanted a pelican to train. He tells Claire its name is Ping An, peaceful one.
It sounded like you just said peeing.
Summer,
on.
You and my diction this evening. He's teaching him to hunt for him. He had bound his wings and now he put a binding around his neck, but not too tightly. He just tight enough so he wouldn't swallow. And then he releases the bindings on the wings. Ping An tied.
Now you have me thinking of it whenever I say it.
See? It's your fault.
Ping
no,
on.
Don't insult the bird or the Chinese language. Ping An tied onto a line, soared as far as it would let him.
Sorry.
Mr. Willoughby played the pelican like a kite, walking around the deck with a line, allowing the bird to fly around. The bird caught a fish and was pulled back to the boat. He received some of it, and the rest went to Willoughby. Fascinating. Within a week, we learn the bird was tame and was able to fly freely. Mr. Willoughby continues his work Okay, I just realized why I have to say Mr. Willoughby every single time. Because if I just hear the name Willoughby, what do you think of?
Sense and Sensibility.
Yep, and this is not that. So, Mr. Willoughby continues to his work on the deck, making beautiful lines, characters on the white paper. Claire sees him one morning, unobserved, and he writes his signature. He looked over the rail, sighing, and then he folds up his paper and lets it go into the sea. He didn't stay to watch it, but walked away and went below, a dreamy look still on his face. Eileen P. writes, we find Mr. Willoughby defiantly painting Chinese characters on a large white paper on the deck of the ship. While we don't know what he is writing, I imagine it is a story about his past. Perhaps my opinion is based on when he carefully folds the paper and lets it fall into the water. It reminds me of Claire's plastic sandwich wrapper, which symbolized Claire throwing away her old life. Erica B. writes, damn it, Willoughby, fetching that bird. We find out later why he did it and the benefits, but come on. Jumping in with the sharks, I'm not sure it was worth it. Also, I'm sorry, Murphy, but Shark Tale, anything, does not sound good to me. And of course, the entire ship is fussing with the shark. Light bulbs appear over Jamie and Claire, and they take full advantage. Who can blame them? Now, I want to know why these guys don't knock on a closed door. Don't these guys have manners? What if something was using someone was using a chamber pot or whatever? I know the ship has heads, but still. I find it quite amazing that Mr. Willoughby is able to tame this bird, and I'm very curious as to what exactly he was writing. You know, I mean, a 15-year-old Marsali didn't knock on her dad's door. It just doesn't seem, privacy was not something that was I don't think it was, especially on ship, I just don't think it was really there because they were in Jamie's room, right? Because the desk was there. It wasn't like they went to Claire's room. People know that the couples are separated right now. I don't think it was, would it have been nice? Of course, but I don't think it was expected that they would be in there together. At least doing that. Joe B. writes, a shark swimming by the ship and the consequent wet clothing provide an opportunity to square the accounts. And to share the accounts, too. Why not? Naturally, there are interruptions. This time, the solicitous but ill-timed Innes leaves Jamie and Claire thinking they definitely need a bigger boat. Using birds to catch fish was a well-known technique for fishermen in Asia. Some still use cormorants. The birds get to eat some of the fish. In the travel cooking show I saw it, the bird got to eat every seventh fish, and he knew it. That's fascinating. Joe, you find all this stuff out. You and Erica are like kicking our butts. My goodness. Lisa T. writes, the scene reminds me of Claire tossing away the wrapping paper of we got common themes here. Tossing away the wrapping of her sandwich when she first arrives. Tossing away the last remnant of her life. She watches it go. Mr. Willoughby does not.
And that was chapter 44. Join us next time when we'll be discussing chapters 45, 46, and 47.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code Outlander20, Outlander20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Outlander Pod.